Officials are preparing trucks for rescue missions should they become necessary. The storm moved through Alabama over the weekend before reversing course. Forecasters say slow movement and heavy rain will continue through tomorrow and Wednesday when the system is finally expected to push across Tennessee, the Western Carolinas, and the Appalachians. For NPR News, I'm Steve Chiotakis in Birmingham.
Oil prices have settled back to about $114 a barrel after rising briefly earlier today. Gasoline prices have fallen further over the past 2 weeks, down 15 cents a gallon. The national average for self-service regular is now $3.70 a gallon. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Industrials are down 142 points. The Nasdaq Composite Index is off 39. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from sitforless.com, supporting NPR for 5 years, and introducing the Zodi office chair by Hayworth, online at sitforless.com.
Programs on WILL are made possible with support from Sinfonia de Camera. Sinfonia, under the musical direction of Ian Hobson, wishes to thank their patrons for 25 wonderful years and invites everyone to a season of beloved classics, rare works, and exciting new pieces. More information is available at 333-6280. Support for today's broadcast comes from World Gourmet Foods, now in their new location at 105 Krispy Kreme Drive in Bloomington. The grand opening will be held on Saturday, September 13th, with a large food show featuring more than 500 samples. Information at worldgourmetfoods.com, bringing the taste of the world to Bloomington Normal.
Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of our morning talk program, Focus 580. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. The internal combustion engine is a major source of the pollution that contributes to global warming. So this morning, we want to spend some time talking about this question. Can we develop a passenger vehicle that meets our transportation needs while at the same time reducing our dependence on oil and also reducing emissions? We'll talk a little bit about the effort to develop a more environmentally friendly passenger vehicles this morning with two guests, and both of them work with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Jim Cleish is an expert on clean and efficient vehicle technologies. He's a senior engineer with the Union of Concerned Scientists Clean Vehicles Program and has done a lot of writing on this subject, books, articles, reports for both technical people and average people, looking at a lot of different subjects, including vehicle technology evaluations, impact assessments of vehicle policies on global warming pollution, and also America's oil addiction. Also joining us is Ron Burke, and he is the director of the Midwest Office of the Union of Concerned Scientists. As the associate director at Illinois EPA, he helped to organize the state's global warming initiative, and that included managing the Illinois Climate Change Advisory Group, overseeing the state's membership in the Chicago Climate Exchange, coordinating the state's communication with Congress on federal climate legislation, also managing the state's participation in the Climate Registry, a multi-state project to measure and track greenhouse gas emissions. So we're pleased to have the two of them with us. They're both joining us by telephone. And also, I do want to mention that if you go to the website of the Union of Concerned Scientists, you can find information on a wide variety of subjects, including global warming and also energy issues, security, food, scientific integrity, and vehicles. And there's a lot of interesting information there. And of course, we're here to answer questions, or the guests are here to answer questions. And if you'd like to call in, pose a question, you can certainly do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. So that's the local number. But if it would be a long-distance call, you're listening around the air, on the air, around Illinois and Indiana, around the country, on the internet, use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. We just ask people to try and be brief so we can get in as many as possible. But certainly, questions are welcome. Mr. Cleish, hello.
Hello, yes.
Thanks for being with us. And Mr. Burke.
Hi there.
Appreciate you giving us some of your time. Just as a kind of a general question, I think probably, you know, in the past when we've talked about issues like this and about transportation, there are people who argue that really if we want to deal with pollution and we want to deal with dependence on oil, what we've got to do is get people away from the the individual passenger vehicle and get them into mass transit or perhaps get them walking or biking or so forth. And while that's a fine idea, I guess I find myself wondering, given our commitment to the personal transportation vehicle, cars and small trucks and so forth, given our commitment to that, and given the fact that, you know, depending on where you live and what you do, you might really need a vehicle like that, how realistic is it that we would get people away from them? Or do you think that for the foreseeable future, we're still going to have a lot of cars on the road?
David, there's no question. For the foreseeable future, we are going to have a lot of cars on the road. You know, between 1950 and 2005, our population doubled in this country. At the same time, the number of vehicles in operation increased by more than a factor of five. So there's no question that the number of vehicles that we have and that we have to deal with are not going to go anywhere anytime soon. Now, that's not to say that we shouldn't pursue options for reducing the amount of time that we spend in the cars. You know, if you live in a big city and you've got mass transit available, or if you live in a situation where you can walk to your place of employment or to the community around you, by all means, that's the best option. Similar for being able to bike in your neighborhood. But I mean, the hard truth is that we are so addicted to oil and so beholden to the automobile that we really do need to get ourselves into more efficient modes of transport.
Yeah. Well, just to stay with what it is we know right for the moment, the vehicles that are liquid, our standard liquid transportation vehicles. So either we're talking about gasoline, we're talking about diesel, ethanol, some combination of those things. Just as a basic sort of question, could we design an internal combustion engine that would be essentially what we have now or something like what we have now? But how far do you think we could push mileage? What really do you think we could get in terms of mileage? And how much do you think that we could also reduce emissions? I mean, what is that technology capable of? And is it capable of more than we're getting from it today?
We looked at this exact question, actually, to try to get ascertain a better idea about what technology was available in the over the next 25 years, for say, looking at different technologies and not advanced technologies, but looking at, you know, conventional gasoline engines, looking at the use of lightweight materials, use of hybrid electric designs, you know, for where you have a vehicle design akin to the Toyota Prius, for example. And we found that we can get to a fleet average fuel economy, which is all the cars and trucks, new cars and trucks for a given model year, their average fuel economy when combined, a fleet average fuel economy of 35 miles per gallon in 2015. Now, that's by comparison, we're at 25 mpg today. So a 40% improvement in fuel economy could be achieved by 2015. And those numbers were corroborated by a recent Bush administration analysis that came out and essentially said the same thing. Now, in the latter years, we think that a fuel economy in the low 40s is reasonable by 2020, and a fuel economy in the neighborhood of about 55 mpg would be achievable in 2030.
Hmm. And we already know now that there are some cars that will get pretty impressive mileage, certainly better than the average. They tend to be small, so I suppose that's an issue. Is it what we're talking about here, the kind of technology, is it particularly exotic? I mean, how different, you know, say you have a car, you could have a car that could get 50 miles to the gallon or 40 miles to the gallon. Is that engine really so different?
Not necessarily. I mean, we have cars on the road today, as you point out. A good example, sort of the showcase example, is the Toyota Prius. It averages in the high 40s in terms of its fuel economy, both city and highway combined. And there's really nothing magical about it. It's just it has a electric motor under the hood in addition to an internal combustion engine. And with the use of some savvy computer programming allows the vehicle to operate, you know, very efficiently. Now, what we're going to be seeing in the coming years are some even more sophisticated designs. There are a host of ideas out there, but one of the popular ones is what's called a plug-in electric hybrid vehicle, also known as a PHEV, which is basically the same idea of a Prius-like vehicle, except that it has a plug that you can plug it into an outlet and use electricity that comes off of the electric power grid. That could be a game changer. I mean, the technology is improving, and GM has said they're going to have a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle on the market in 2010. But if we can get ourselves, and there's some challenges still with the cost of the technology and the durability of the batteries, but if we can get ourselves into a situation where we have advanced vehicles that use electricity from the power grid, then we're talking about a game-changing technology that could really allow us to extract ourselves from our dependence on oil.
This is sort of a policy question. Maybe Ron Burke would want to weigh in on this, because certainly, and there has been for I don't know how long, a lot of debate and discussion in Washington about the issue of mandating fuel economy and whether that's a good thing or not. And I think that some people have said, well, if you really want to get fuel economy, you pass a law that says you got to do it, and that's the one. That's what's going to push people to the manufacturers developing better cars. And then other people have said, no, we really don't want to do that. And I think some people have felt the government's really dragged its heels on that issue. What do you think about that? And whether, in fact, if you really want to push designers in that direction to build engines that get better fuel economy, you're going to have to pass a law that says, all right, now we expect you to do it, and not just a little bit at a time, but something really dramatic.
Well, in fact, that's been proven to be the case, really. We've got federal fuel economy standards on the books already. As you may know, they've been on the books for 25, 30 years, but up until last year, they had not been strengthened for, I think it's over 20 years. Mm-hmm. And in fact, fuel economy, average fuel economy across the fleet, meaning the average fuel economy between passenger cars, light-duty trucks, and so forth, had actually been slipping, in large part because the federal fuel economy standards, often referred to as CAFE standards, mm-hmm. had not been strengthened. And so we've seen this trend where, the automakers have not made more fuel-efficient vehicles unless they've been required to do so. Historically, the auto manufacturers have argued that making these more fuel-efficient vehicles would be cost-prohibitive, you go back to some of the last changes and the last times that those federal standards were strengthened back in for example, in the 80s, the automakers were at that time saying we're going to be left with nothing but a fleet of small little Pintos, you know, out on the road.
Yeah.
And needless to say, that didn't come to pass. When those standards were strengthened back then, in fact, the fleet, if anything, has gotten much larger over time. The good news, I think, is that, and this is in large part due to the efforts of a lot of concerned citizens, the Union of Concerned Scientists, and some other environmental groups, that the federal fuel economy standards were strengthened last year, and now we're on track to have average fuel economy across the fleet, 35 miles per gallon by the year 2020. However, as Jim just pointed out, we can do so much better than that. In fact, we're very hopeful that the new president, be it McCain or Obama, would actually increase those standards even more so. The federal agency that's working on the rulemaking to decide just how stringent those standards should be, again, I'm talking about the federal fuel economy standards. They have not made their final decision yet. I should probably clarify that those standards can actually be have to be at least an average of 35 miles per gallon by 2020. If the federal agencies decide that the technologies are available to be even stronger, then they can choose to do so. And so we're urging them to take that route. We're urging we will be urging the new president, whomever that is, to make sure that we're doing all we can to improve fuel economy across the fleet. This is the single most cost-effective way to reduce our consumption of oil, our reliance on imported oil, to enhance our energy security and our energy independence.
We have two guests with us this morning. Last fellow you heard, that's Ron Burke. He is the director of the Midwest Office of the Union of Concerned Scientists. And also joining us is Jim Cleese. He is an expert on clean and efficient vehicle technologies, and he is a senior engineer with the Union of Concerned Scientists Clean Vehicles Program. And we're talking here about the potential for auto transportation in the future and what kind of things that could be done in terms of redesign of cars to make them more efficient, less dependent on oil, and less polluting. Questions are welcome. We have a couple of people get right to 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, by the way, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Peru is our first caller here in line on our toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Good subject. You know, what I'm looking at is everybody's out there is on the bandwagon about getting more fuel-efficient cars and, you know, doing away with gas entirely. Well, the problem people seem to forget, lubricants. Everything out there is lubricated with some kind of, petroleum product. And the other thing is, we could have had cars years ago that got 30-plus miles a gallon on a tank. You know, the problem is I firmly believe the car manufacturers and the oil companies are in cahoots with each other because it would put one or both, if not out of business, they wouldn't be making the billions of dollars they do every year. What I see is you're going to have 15 different kinds of cars out there. It's going to be electric. You're going to have solar. You're going to have this. And that's all fine and said, you know, that's a good thing. The problem I see is how are you going to build the infrastructure? How are you going to get – how are you going to be able to have a place – to go plug in your car, for instance, that most people don't understand. It isn't going there and wait 15, 20 minutes or even a half an hour. From what I understand, even the most fuel-efficient car with batteries, electric-wise, has to take up to 3 hours to charge and only goes 150 miles on a charge. So, and I know people right now who drive probably more than that sometimes during the daytime. If you want to take a trip, in other words, the travel industry would go to tubes because a lot of people drive. I mean, there's a lot of problems with it, and there's no answers to it. Nobody seems to be answering it. I'll get off and listen. Thank you very much.
Okay. The caller raised a number of points. I don't know which you would like to respond to. I guess to me, I think his point, his infrastructure point is certainly something that's important to talk about, and that is if you're talking about alternative fuels. So maybe you do want to talk about hydrogen, and I expect we have some people who might, or you want to talk about have more of a plug-in kind of a deal, you're going to have a system that can support that. And right now, we're still very heavily into this system that's basically about the liquid transportation fuels that we know.
That's right, David. That's absolutely right. All of these advanced technologies that we're talking about, whether it's the near-term stuff like the plug-in hybrid electric vehicles or battery electric vehicles or hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, all of those will require advances in infrastructure, and these are not solutions that are going to occur overnight. The good news is that some of the technologies such as the plug-in hybrids that GM is talking about bringing out in 2010. We're talking about low-volume vehicles, and are they going to work for everybody in 2010? No. You know, if you live in the inner city somewhere where you're parking on the street and you don't have a regular parking space, access to the power grid for your vehicle is a challenge, and those are issues that engineers that the electric power research facilities are looking at, that the automakers are looking at. Again, these are not solutions that are going to occur overnight. And as your caller pointed out, they're things that are going to take some time and effort. Now, it's worth pointing out, the caller mentioned electric vehicles that have limited range and require a few hours to charge. All of that is true with battery electric vehicles. These are like the EV1 that was in the featured in the movie Who Killed the Electric Car. That's one of the shortcomings of pure electric vehicles, is that if the only source of power that you have is an onboard battery, then once you deplete that energy, you need to recharge your car, and that's going to take some time. A plug-in hybrid electric vehicle really merges that technology with the technology that you see on the road today with the Toyota Prius, which is or the Honda Civic Hybrid or any of the other hybrids on the road. The design of the vehicle is such that it operates as an electric vehicle for a given period of time, and after you deplete the amount of electricity on board from the battery system, it switches over and then behaves like a regular Prius or Civic Hybrid or, you know, any other hybrid electric vehicle. So you don't have the range limitations. There is a gas tank on board. It allows you to, you know, if you're driving a short distance for a daily commute, you may well use very little gasoline. But if you want to take that cross-country trip, this vehicle, a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle, won't limit your ability to do that.
Yeah, I guess I find myself wondering whether there might be some applications, particularly people who live in urban areas, where they're not going to drive very many miles. You know, say maybe they'll drive less than 100 miles in a day, where they don't have to go at highway speeds. Whether that might actually be there might actually be some place for an all electric, a small all electric vehicle.
Yeah, no, without question. In fact, you know, one of the best applications for alternative fuels, and this applies not only to electricity but also to, you know, natural gas and other types of alternative fuels. One of the best applications of those technologies, where you do have range limitations, or you need to be sure that you're going to have a facility where you're going to be able to refuel the vehicle. One of the best applications is fleets, government fleets. Those are vehicles that, you know, go out during the day to do whatever, driving around checking on parking meters, for example. They do their thing during the day. They're all in sort of a limited locale, and in the evening they come back to a central location where you could site a central refueling station and refuel the vehicles there. So that's one of the things that we see already. You know, there are pure electric vehicles and alternative fuel vehicles that see excellent use as fleet vehicles and fleet applications.
Uh-huh. And David,
yes.
This is, you know, your point about certain situations where drivers might find an all electric vehicle to be a really good fit. We're seeing that more and more as gasoline prices go up and up. Having come down recently, that's true. But in the long run, you know, the experts are predicting the prices will continue to go up. We're seeing more people being creative in how they get around, not just by taking more mass transit, as you pointed out earlier in the show, but you've probably heard about the stories in certain communities throughout central Illinois where folks are starting to use their electric golf carts to get around town,
sure.
You know, because it gets them from point A to point B. Why not? I know up here in the Chicago area, there are some kind of niche manufacturers of all electric cars that are have seen their sales go way up. But, you know, obviously, that's, as Jim points out, that technology is not going to work for everybody, at least not in the short term. But there are plenty of variations on the standard internal combustion engine that allow us to get much, much better fuel economy than we're getting today, that can save you know, Illinois drivers literally tens of thousands of dollars over the life of a car. This is not insignificant, putting more money in their pockets, which is ultimately better for the state's economy, as you might imagine, while at the same time reducing our dependence on foreign oil, which has all kinds of repercussions as well. And we talked a little bit about the federal fuel economy standards and how important those are. Well, one of the reasons that the federal government adopted tighter standards last year after 20 years was because more and more states were going out and adopting what are called clean car standards on their own, modeled after standards adopted in California. 12 states have already adopted these tighter standards for emissions of pollutants that cause smog and soot, but also emissions of carbon dioxide, which is the primary contributor to climate change. And the primary way we think that those tighter carbon dioxide limits will be met is through improved fuel economy. So what you have is, roughly 40% of the market, represented by these 12 states, they're moving towards much more aggressive fuel economy standards vis-a-vis this carbon dioxide limitation. And the automakers were, I think, getting a bit concerned about having these different standards between and seeing the writing on the wall, really, where fuel economy was going to improve in these 12 states anyway. Why not make it happen at the federal level? So I point this out in large part because there's a bill pending in Illinois right now that would adopt these clean car standards that the Union of Concerned Scientists supports wholeheartedly, while we're optimistic that the federal fuel economy standards will get stronger still and ultimately match what is happening indirectly through these clean car standards. We're not sure if that's going to happen. In the meantime, we're hoping that the state legislature will move forward with this piece of legislation, which, again, will ultimately save Illinois consumers money by allowing them to purchase vehicles that use less gas.
We have two guests with us this morning. Ron Burke is the director of the Midwest Office of the Union of Concerned Scientists, and Jim Cleish is an expert on clean and efficient vehicle technologies. He's a senior engineer with the Union of Concerned Scientists Clean Vehicles Program. You're interested in this and other kinds of issues having to do with things like global warming and energy and security, go to the website of the Union of Concerned Scientists. Just put that in your browser and you can find it. And there's a lot of information there I think that you would find interesting. And we have a bunch of callers here. We want to get right back to it. And our next person in line in Belgium, not that far away from us, here, line number one. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to all. As Mr. Inge knows, I am a strong proponent of hydrogen. Use it in a fuel cell. And I understand that there are infrastructure limitations, but I must point out that in 1900, we went through a paradigm change that went from burning hay to burning gasoline. So this is a possible change that we can make. And we could do it in steps. It would be best to go pure hydrogen. There are methods to going partially where you can use a liquid fuel. There's one corporation out in Southern California called Orgiv Protonics that uses methanol to go to a fuel cell feedstock, which would give you a liquid component to put into your vehicle, but yet you would get mileage that, you know, would push you around. Now, I know that hydrogen presents a lot of limitations in that we need to get better at it. But there we can use our technology, and then that technology can be utilized to improve our economies by moving to another basis for us to generate wealth from. There are many aspects of hydrogen that doesn't seem to be entertained at all. What are your feelings about that?
Yeah, Jim, I'm particularly interested in what you think about the potential for hydrogen.
Yeah, we're bullish on hydrogen. I certainly don't want to give the impression that we don't support it or don't think it's going to happen. At the same time, we understand that, you know, there are a number of infrastructure, a number of cost challenges that still need to be met. So, you know, I don't see hydrogen fuel cell vehicles being readily visible in, you know, carports and garages down the street for another couple of decades. But we have to start somewhere. And if we really do want to extract ourselves off of our dependence on oil and we want to get ourselves into a different energy paradigm, and I think hydrogen is a good one, it's going to take some time, and we need to start somewhere. So, you know, as your caller pointed out, there are a number of different ideas that are out there about how to start to move. I mean, this is a very large ball to push, so to speak, and it's going to take some time to get there.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And let's just go right on here. Our next caller is in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yes. The rotary engine appears to be a lot more efficient than the conventional reciprocating engine. Of course, it isn't, or it'd be in dominance today. Could you tell me why? What are the shortcomings of the Wankel or the rotary engine? Would you happen to know?
Well, Jim, is that something you can talk about?
No, I'm not versed on that.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems, you know, once the momentum of the Wankel or the rotary starts turning, then there's no stop at the bottom, stop at the top of the reciprocating piston engine. But, yeah, I thought you might know, but okay, thank you.
All right. That's still, I guess it's a different kind of engine design, but we're still talking about something that's powered by gasoline. So it's still an internal combustion engine. It's just a different kind.
Yeah, I believe Mazda actually used rotary engines in a couple of their...
They did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Well, maybe for a second, we should talk about fuel cells. And then again, I promise we'll get back to callers, because this is another kind of electric vehicle, but this is one that is powered by the fuel cell, and then the fuel cell you can use, that could be powered by hydrogen. You could use gasoline, actually, in a fuel cell. So what you're doing is you're using a chemical reaction to produce electricity, and then electricity is what powers the vehicle. What sort of potential do you think? And this would be something completely different than the conventional internal combustion engine or the electric gasoline hybrid. This would yet be another different sort of thing, which could use conventional feedstocks for fuel or could use other sorts of things. What's the potential, do you think, for using the fuel cell as a power generator for an electric vehicle?
Well, all fuel cell vehicles really are electric vehicles. As you know, the idea of the fuel cell is that you put hydrogen into the fuel cell, so to speak. Electrons are stripped away from the hydrogen atoms. Those electrons become the electricity that powers the vehicle. And oxygen carries into the formula, and your output chemically is water or water vapor. So the question is, where do you get your hydrogen from? One idea, the most popular idea today is to use pure hydrogen, so that when you go to the station, the filling station, you are actually pumping hydrogen gas into your tank. Now, there have been some other ideas out there about, what's called reform hydrogen from other sources, such as gasoline or certain solid pellets that would allow you to generate hydrogen on board the vehicle. Those are interesting ideas. There are some technical challenges and some cost challenges associated with those in terms of doing that effectively and being able to continue to do that without poisoning your system. There are a lot of pollutants with the use of gasoline. There's obviously, they're very complex chemicals, and using them to reform or reforming that gasoline into hydrogen has some significant challenges ahead of it.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk next with someone in Bloomington, Indiana, I believe. This is line number four.
Hi. Let me ask you to comment on a little different direction from transportation fuel economy and focus. We've made a lot of progress in creating a virtual workplace. How about a substantial tax credit for every mile of employee travel that an employer can eliminate? We've got these virtual workplaces now where people don't have to go to work. They can conference with full video conference from remote locations. They can get their work assignments, submit their work product virtually. When you became an employee of a company, you would have installed in your house a video conferencing mechanism, and there wouldn't have to be a physical office at all. You just stay at home. When you reported to work, you would report by video conference. The rush hours, rush hours nowadays in major cities are exasperating. They're time-consuming. Even if we didn't have a fuel problem, the rush hours are time-consuming and exasperating, and they consume emotional energy. How about giving a substantial tax credit to every mile of employee travel that a company can eliminate?
Well, there certainly are some people who now can do some of their work at home. This is pretty much moving it into a dramatically different direction. If we could make it so that no one would ever have to go to work, or a lot of people would not have to go to work, this is obviously a different sort of we're getting us into a different area. But you can certainly comment on that.
Yeah, this is Ron again. Telecommuting obviously is becoming more and more popular, in part because technology is enabling it. And more recently, I suppose, because fuel prices have gotten to be so high. In cities that have substantial rush hours, flex schedules have also become more popular, allowing folks to come in earlier or later to avoid the rush, right? And these are all good strategies. And the idea that the caller raised of creating a tax incentive for employees not to drive is an interesting one. Might be difficult to measure. I'm not sure how you kind of create the baseline of, what an employee workforce mileage, should be. But certainly there are incentives similar to this that some employers already offer. For example, if you live in a city that has mass transit, often you can buy your mass transit tickets and passes pre-tax, which can save you some money. That's a good strategy. I think probably the message, really the take-home message I'm getting from the caller's point is that, we need to be looking at all kinds of strategies, right, to reduce vehicle use, to improve fuel economy, whatever, to deal with these soaring gasoline prices. And certainly one option that's being employed more and more is telecommuting. It's an interesting idea. We'll have to look into that.
All right. Let's go on to talk with someone next in Effingham. This would be line 3. Hello.
Yes. A couple of things, David. Thank you. I heard one of the gentlemen use the words paradigm change, and I agree with that. But we can't continue, in my opinion, to nuance the paradigm that we now live in. I don't know if either of your guests have approached the things being discussed here and the magnitude of the continuity of it. The U.S., which makes up, 5% of the world's population, and we consume everything, upwards to 55% of the world's goods. Well, based on that alone, and if we try to exercise the paradigm we use here around the world, the Earth can't stand it. It already can't stand it because of the global warming and other things. People say, no, this has happened before with global warming before humans got here. Well, I'm sure that those things did happen, but what is occurring now, I think, is pretty much the scientific community says that it is human, has human origins. So my question is, how is it possible we're all going to have individual travel with polluting vehicles, and then with the 6.2 billion people that exist here and however many families that constitutes with one or two carbon-based engines, it'll be dark.
Yeah.
And we won't be able to function like that. So thanks, David. I'll hang up.
Sure. This, again, gets us into a different set of issues, but I know it indeed is the kind of thing that the Union of Concerned Scientists is well concerned about and has been for some time. And again, you can respond to that any way that you like.
Yeah. This is Ron again. Clearly one of the main reasons that people like Jim and our staff and our organization are advocating for stronger fuel economy standards and other strategies, technology advancements to reduce gasoline consumption is because the transportation sector accounts for about 1/4 of our nation's greenhouse gas emissions. And the caller's right. The scientific community has truly reached a consensus that, A, global warming is happening, and, B, it's primarily being caused by
human activities, although there are still a few naysayers out there, there is a remarkable degree of consensus within the scientific community, which is not easy to achieve. There are a number of scientists there in the Champaign-Urbana area, and they know. Scientists, one of their main missions in life is to be critical, and to question things. And so to have this level of consensus in the scientific community about climate change is truly amazing. Now, I think the caller's other point is that we may have to look at some type of behavior change, right, in addition to technology advancement, in order to avoid these dangerous consequences of climate change. And there's a lot of debate about that. Certainly, we're seeing some behavior change already just in response to increasing gasoline prices. I think, for the first time in a long time, vehicle miles traveled in this country have actually flattened out rather than growing at about a 1% to 2% rate per year. So voluntarily, we're already seeing some behavior change. More and more, you see folks, homeowners, apartment owners, businesses are all on their own switching to so-called greener technologies and greener building practices, whether it's compact fluorescent light bulbs, more energy-efficient appliances and furnaces, and so forth. So, all these voluntary kind of individual actions are crucial to avoiding the climate crisis, but they certainly are not going to, on their own, meet our objectives in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions and achieving energy independence in this country, which is why we have to continue to focus on really both technology advancement all at the same time. Some of that advancement will happen through mandates. We talked about fuel economy standards. Some of that advancement is going to happen just because folks are responding to the market, responding to increasing prices, and people want to do the right thing. They want to make their homes and their businesses as green as possible.
Okay, well, let's go to another call here. Back to someone else in Belgium, line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Bill Lear, who invented the Learjet?
Yes.
Okay. Back in the early 70s, he invented an engine, and he put it into a truck, and they drove it around the country, and it would not break down. And this was just a steam engine. No, I'm sorry, it wasn't a truck. It was a bus. And so the technology is there.
Well, I think I appreciate the point of the caller. I think that we kind of started out talking about the fact that even the internal combustion engine that we know now could be made much, much more efficient. We could get much better mileage. It could pollute less. And that one good step would be to start right there. And we would continue to use essentially the same kind of fuels, but we could do much better. And that's just a matter of the determination of either the automakers to build those engines or the government to come along and say, well, here we're going to start to mandate greater economy, and so you're going to have to do it. I think, again, that gets back to the point that with the technology we have now, we could do a lot.
That's right, David. And following up on what Ron was saying with the previous caller, the amount of carbon dioxide, global warming pollution that our passenger cars and light trucks alone put out exceeds the total CO2 emissions of all but two other countries in the world, those being China and Russia. We just slightly exceed the total CO2 emissions of India and Japan. So the magnitude of global warming pollution put out by our cars and trucks is huge. And so increasing fuel economy is really the low-hanging fruit at this point. I mean, it's a simple way to dramatically reduce the amount of CO2 pollution that we're putting out into the atmosphere. Now, is that going to by itself avert the climate crisis? No, it's not. We need an 80. Our climate scientists tell us we need an 80% reduction in CO2 emissions from 1990 levels by 2050. And that's going to require really a concerted effort on all fronts, power generation, the vehicles, fuels, getting to use low-carbon fuels, cutting down on the amount of travel that we're doing, sometimes referred to as reducing demand. It's really going to require, a multifaceted front.
We have about 5 minutes left in this hour of focus. We have two guests, Jim Cleish. He is a senior engineer with the Union of Concerned Scientists Clean Vehicles Program, and Ron Burke. He is the director of the Midwest Office of the Union of Concerned Scientists. And we're talking about auto transportation of the future and how cars can be improved and passenger vehicles could be improved to burn less fuel, put out less pollution, and perhaps use a kind of a fuel that it's different than what we use now. Questions, welcome. We do have several, and we'll try to get them in. And next, go to Champaign in line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Just to answer a call, or there was a question raised by a previous caller about the rotary engine. I have owned a couple of them over the years. They aren't very thermal efficient. The amount of power they produce per pound of fuel consumed is lower than a reciprocating engine. I don't know why, but that's just the way it is. And they tend to have a very short life. They're only good for about 100,000 miles before the tip seals wear out. But what I would like to ask you about or have you comment upon is, to my way of thinking, one point that needs to be addressed in this entire question is that of making the average motorist think a little more about what he or she is doing, and to think about the type of vehicle they have and why they have it and so forth. And as an example, there seems to be this underlying notion in many people's minds that I have to have a vehicle that's perfectly capable of doing perfectly everything for me anytime I want. So it has to get 50 miles a gallon, but it also has to be big enough to haul Mom, Dad, Junior, and Sis and the Black Lab on a road trip with a load of luggage and so forth from here to Wyoming and back, and so on and so forth. And to my way of thinking, it might be smarter, and it would be better if the public could be educated this way. Why don't you think about owning your personal transportation, sizing it to what you need most of the time, and then on those occasions when you need something else that's bigger or has a different capacity, then you rent it. You know, as an example, I know hundreds of people who drive pickup trucks who carry nothing in their pickup truck ever or seldom. And on those rare occasions where they actually needed it, you know, like 2 or 3 days a year, well, you know, you can rent a pickup truck for $20 a day. I mean, that's and large American sedans or a large American station wagon for the so-called road trip. Well, again, you can rent those for not much money, and certainly not for what it costs to, you know, drive this huge hulking thing around all year long for the time when you need it for maybe 2 weeks out of the year or a week out of the year or whatever. If you would comment on that, please. Thank you.
Yeah, all right. I think the caller makes a great point. I don't know which or both of you would like to weigh in.
Well, I'll respond by saying he's clearly right. You know, the right sizing, if you will, of the passenger vehicle fleet in this country is could be a big contributor to reducing greenhouse gas emissions and reducing fuel consumption. Now, we're already seeing this happen, of course. SUV sales, for example, have fallen off dramatically, and that's in large part because people who don't necessarily need an SUV are no longer buying them. When I was with the state of Illinois, the state, and I think they're still doing this, made a real effort to right-size its own fleet, recognizing that there were too many pickup trucks and SUVs out there, and the state started to buy some smaller cars, hybrids, and so forth. The price signal alone, just from, you know, I guess this is one of the part of the silver lining, if you will, of having high gas prices. Obviously, it's a problem in so many different ways, but one of the silver linings is that folks are making smarter decisions about which vehicles to buy.
Well, and I think that the point is well taken that, you know, when we talk about what's going to be the vehicle of the future, and it's probably going to be vehicles, and that is, it's going to depend a lot on what it is, on, as the caller says, on what's the intended use. You know, what do you need the vehicle to do? And that seems that it's likely we're going to have more of a mix of different kinds of vehicles, different sizes, and maybe also different ways of powering them, and much more diversity than we have now. And,
you know, yeah, and a good example of that is, you know, I take my own personal situation with, you know, young kids and carpooling around town and, you know, looking for a minivan that gets good fuel economy has been a challenge. And yet I know that Ford, for example, sells what essentially is a minivan with three rows of seats in Europe that averages 35 miles per gallon. That's combined city and highway. It's using existing technologies. As Jim pointed out, there's a lot of potential there. They're not selling it here in the United States, unfortunately, but it's just another example of how we can vastly improve fuel economy and still meet the needs of drivers who are out there. But, David, your point's well taken as well. There may be a shift as folks move away from these bigger vehicles that they don't necessarily need, finding the one that really meets their needs and potentially borrowing or renting others on those few occasions where they need something larger.
Yeah. Well, we're pretty much at the point here where we're going to have to stop. My apologies. We have a couple of people we can't take. I'm sure that we can get back to some of these topics again and will. Before we go, though, let me just I want to go turn to Jim and Jim Cleish and say any sort of last idea that you'd like to leave with folks.
You know, I think just following up on the most recent point, while I wholeheartedly agree with the caller and everything that you and Ron just said, for those consumers who are in the need for, or who do have a need for large trucks, they should bear in mind that a couple MPG can actually make a huge difference in terms of the amount of oil savings when you're talking about trucks that consume that much. And so just to give you an example, if they're looking at two SUVs on the showroom floor, one gets 14 MPG, one gets 16 MPG, the amount of oil that they'll save annually by getting the more fuel-efficient one that just gets 2 MPG better is the same amount of oil that one would save if you were considering a 35 MPG mid-sized compact car in a 51 MPG compact car. So a 2 MPG increase at the low end of the fuel economy spectrum will save as much oil as a 16 MPG increase further up the spectrum. So it's all to make the point that if you do need to buy those vehicles, if you do need a large pickup truck, if you do need a large SUV, opting for the more efficient engine or the one that has slightly less power but offers a couple MPG boost is going to pay off in spades in terms of the amount of oil saved, in terms of your wallet, and in terms of carbon dioxide emissions.
Right.
An excellent point, Jim, because we know that in central Illinois, for example, there are a number of farmers. And look, a truck is just a tool of the trade. You know, having grown up in farming country, I know this. So all the more important that these more fuel-efficient options are available for trucks and some of these larger vehicles. And again, at the Union of Concerned Scientists, we're working real hard to try to make sure that those options, those more fuel-efficient options, are more readily available in the future.
Well, there we've got to stop. Our two guests, Ron Burke, he is the director of the Midwest Office of the Union of Concerned Scientists. And Ron, thank you very much. And Jim Cleish, he's senior engineer with the Union of Concerned Scientists Clean Vehicles Program. Jim, thank you.
My pleasure.
And again, for people who want to read more about this or other sorts of issues, take a look at the website of the Union of Concerned Scientists. That's www.ucsusa.org. WILO programs made possible in part by Bevere Cafe, offering breakfast from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. and lunches from 11:30 to 1, Monday through Friday, and catering. Bevere Cafe is student-operated on the second floor of Bevere Hall at the corner of Gregory and Goodwin in Urbana. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. More coming up in the way of news and features and other things as part of the afternoon magazine. And today in the 1 o'clock hour, a chance for people to call in and ask computer questions. Celeste Quinn is the host of the show.
Thank you very much, David. That is correct. This afternoon at 1:06, that's following the 1 o'clock news, we'll talk with Peter Kimball of the Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. We'll talk with him about computers. It's our monthly Computers in You show. Later this afternoon, I'll talk with someone from the Consumers Union about some of the things that we do online that aren't too smart. We'll talk with him about the 7 biggest online blunders. He will join us following the closing market report this afternoon. That will be Jeff Fox. Let's take a look now at what is happening in the commodity markets in Kansas City. September wheat is trading at 885, down 15. December, 907 and a half, down 15 and a half. In Chicago, September wheat, 853 and a half, down 12. December, 875, down 15 and a half. March, 898, down 17. September corn, 587 and three quarters, up 1 1/4. December, 606 and a half, unchanged. March, 626, up 1/4. May, 638, up 1/4. September beans, 1348, up 27. November, 1351 and a half, up 24 and a half. January, 1379, up 34 and a half. March, 1376, up 17 and three quarters. September soybean meal, 370 even, up 970. September oil, 54.60.